Welcome to yet another episode of Safe Space, the ABA podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Zeman. Please be sure to listen to those two code words so that way you can get your free CEUs. So my guests for today's podcast episode are the authors of Spectrum of Independence. I had a chance to read this book, and let me tell you, I cannot recommend it enough. I'm super excited to speak with these two fabulous people, Christine Drew and Kristen Lombardi. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. We're so happy to be here.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I'm super excited to be talking to you guys. Your book is so wonderful. I'm really just so impressed by what all you wrote in there. My first question for you guys is, what inspired you both to write Spectrum of Independence, and why now?
I'll start with that, and then maybe Christine will jump in. We actually met at a conference for inclusive higher ed. We were up in Syracuse at the State of the Art conference. And we were at a table where I was the only one there from like the birth to, you know, through high school, sort of birth to 21 educator. And then everybody else was working in inclusive higher ed. And there was this discussion about how the students were not as independent as they would like them to be when they arrived, you know, on campus. And that sometimes there was a misunderstanding on the parents' end of like what independence really meant as far as being ready for one of these programs. And so after the lunch, I said to Christine, like, you know, the parents are so involved during that birth to 21 phase to even get them ready for these programs. And it's very hard to go from having to be so involved to make sure everything's being done properly to all of a sudden being basically out of the picture. And maybe we should write a book to help bridge that gap from you raising them to you getting them ready to actually dropping them off.
Yeah, and we, you know, I taught middle school in a behavior classroom, and I watched the way that services declined as they went from 6th to 7th to 8th grade, sort of regardless of progress. So by middle school, you know, like you can't find a speech therapist on a middle school campus. You can't, you know, there's all these supports that end up being removed sometimes before students are ready. And then so that sort of built my passion for adolescence and that being neglected in research. And then I came to Auburn University. We have an inclusive higher ed program, and I teach sex ed to these freshmen. And there are pitfalls for independence, even, and Auburn is a very competitive program to get into, you know, 70 applicants for 10 spots maximum. And we were still having, you know, these independence issues, right? So they would come to campus and they parents would say, oh, they're independent in this. And then, you know, by week three, we're not taking showers because it rained on us while we were outside, and that counts as a shower.
Interesting. That's right. So interesting.
Right. Or, you know, we would, yeah, there's just been things that I really stood out to me as, you know, the parents are not, they're not lying. They're not telling us, oh, my kid can do this and they can't. It's that they don't necessarily understand the support they're providing to their young adult to get those things done. So they're saying, oh, they're independent, not realizing that by looking at them pointedly and saying, I think it's time to shower, that's a prompt, right? And if you have to do that every time your young adult showers, they are not, in fact, independent at showering. And you're not there to smell them when they get ripe and give them that prompt. They are on their own to have those prompts internalized or externalized in some way. It was a great meeting of the minds, because Kristen brought an empathy to the problem that I think, again, us in inclusive higher ed, we maybe do finger wagging, right? We talk about like, well, the high school did this and we're dealing with this and the parents didn't know. And she brought it back to what I already knew was true, which is that our parents have been fighting for their young adults since sometimes before they were born. They get these diagnoses, they get a scan, and they are immediately advocating, fighting, you know, or they don't get a diagnosis until the kid is five and they've been fighting, they've been advocating. And then all this continue until this young adult is 22. They drop them off to campus. They've been fighting for 23 years at this point. And then we go, okay, bye. Bye. See you at, you know, we have an acclimation period. Parents cannot come on campus for the first like 3 to 4 weeks. And we say, trust us with this person that you have been fighting for and advocating for 22 years. Just trust us. We got it. So it's, yeah, it brought that piece back to our perceptions, which was really helpful. We're very appreciative of Kristen.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for sharing that, you know, and I do agree as far as, you know, services for adults, things for adults. There's definitely a lot for, you know, younger neurodiverse children. There's a lot of services. There's a lot of things that are more available for students that are younger. But I definitely have seen it firsthand where, you know, a middle school child or even a high school student, an adult, the services almost run dry because, well, you know, you would have assumed that they would have gotten the support when they were younger. Now that they're an adult, why should they have those services? So I really appreciate that, especially being an autistic adult myself. This is definitely something that I feel like, in general, there needs to be more advocacy and more for adults that are neurodiverse.
Absolutely. I've had a conversation with insurance companies multiple times that just because the student is doing well and is older doesn't mean that they don't have autism anymore. Like, it doesn't just disappear because they've turned 15, and that the reason they're doing well is because they have the services, because they learn differently. And if you teach them the way that they learn, they can continue to do well. But if you pull everything, you just creating more of a problem. And this, several times has been like a very novel conversation for some of these people to hear that, because the mindset is, well, they're a certain age, so we can just be done.
Yeah. And even, you know, things like social skills, right? So you may have mastered all the 8-year-old social skills, but then when you're 11, the social skills change. And when you're 12, they change again. When, you know, all the way up to you are a college student now, and making friends as a college student is its own challenge. Then try to talk to an adult making friends, right? That's almost a completely separate set of skills than you needed in college to make friends. And so again, like, the skills that you need evolve constantly, right? Like, I bought a house 5 years ago. I have learned so much. I have so many new skills, but every phase of life, we don't get to just say like, oh, they'll pick it up. They'll just figure it out, because we know that that isn't true. And you know, some of the natural consequences, right? So if I don't empty the lint trap on my dryer, my house burns down, right? Yes, you can learn from that if you survive. But these are skills that people need, and that maybe they have not run into until they hit 22, 25, 27, 35. I didn't buy my house until I was 34. So again, the skills don't run out. No adult is like, well, I've learned everything I'm ever going to learn, all done here.
Yeah, exactly. You never stop learning, you know, no matter what stage of life you're in, no matter what age you are, and different things have different requirements, different skill sets have different ways of actually doing that. You know, you mentioned social skills for a 3-year-old versus a 6-year-old versus 10, 12, 15, 18 and beyond. They all look different. There's different behaviors. There's different nuances that we have to learn. And of course, too, you mentioned the independence, buying a house. That's not just something you quote unquote pick up on. That's something that you learn. That's something that, you know, you're not just going to like pick up just from doing it. You know, you're going to learn a lot of different skills along the way. So I really appreciate that you guys went into that. So let's talk a little bit about the culture of dependence. So in your book, you write early on about the culture of dependence. Tell us a little bit more about how that shows up in families and in systems, and how you have guys have seen it shift over time.
So this line came from Peter Gerhardt, who did our foreword, and he really got into it in the foreword about how, coming from the best of places, we were trying to keep people with disabilities safe. And in order to keep them safe, we were just doing everything for them. Like, of course, we're just going to make them dinner. Why would we let them near the stove? But in doing that, we created this culture of dependence where we had these now young adults and adults who maybe could have learned to do a lot of things, but weren't even given the chance to. And on some level, that mindset still takes the place, right? You have to, I tell parents all the time, yes, your child should learn how to use a knife. No, that doesn't mean that you should just freely give them a knife and let them hurt themselves. I learned this at a conference, you buy the gloves that you can't cut through the gloves. So now they can learn to cut and they're still safe. You find ways around it. But when you have that mindset of, like, I need to keep you safe and I'm always going to have to be responsible for you, you can't have that mindset and also be ready to drop your kid off at Inclusive Higher Ed, or ready for them to go into competitive employment, or ready for them to go live on their own, right? They don't align. Christine, do you want to add? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, Peter did an excellent job. We're very grateful to him for writing the intro. and I think this is not, I don't think anyone is thinking this fully, right? They're not thinking, I want my child to be dependent on me forever. That's not how it's going for parents, but there are these logistical barriers, right? So if you don't know about the gloves, or you don't know how to teach knife skills, or you have three other kids that you have to manage while you're working with your young adult with autism to try to teach them to make a sandwich, adding a knife into the mix on top of everything is really difficult. So I think it's something that, you know, happens slowly over time, and it becomes this habit. We talk about in the book a lot, these habits that people have that they don't even recognize how much support they're giving to their child and young adult. And so, yeah, it's this, you know, death by a thousand cuts, right? It's this little thing that builds over time into, now my young adult sits at the bottom of the stairs with their shoes on their feet, but with their shoes untied. And then I tie their shoes every morning, because we just haven't had time. We haven't had the space. I need to get everybody out the door. We have to get on the bus. If they get on the bus going in the wrong direction, it's 40 minutes out of my way to take them. Like, all these things are happening in parents' heads. But what it boils down to is that their young adult or young child stays dependent and stays under their control rather than having that independence.
Absolutely. And, you know, kind of speaking of independence, your book group talks a lot about redefining independence. What does independent actually mean for a neurodiverse child, and how should families think about that for the future?
I think it's different for each kid, which is why we titled the book Spectrum of Independence. It's not a black and white, like, if you're doing X, Y, and Z, you're independent, and if you're not, then you're not independent. I think different kids, independence looks differently for them depending on what their disability is. I'm not answering the question. Tell me, say the question again. I got lost.
That's okay. So your guys' book talks a lot about redefining independence. What does independent actually mean for a neurodiverse child, and how should families think about that for the future?
I think that each parent needs to look at their child, look at what their specific disabilities are, and then come up with what they think is an appropriate level of independence. You want to reach high, right? The worst that happens is you don't make it all the way. But if you don't at least aim high, you're not gonna make it, right? So set the bar high and aim for it. if you have a student, you know, we talk about this in the book, like if you have a student that has a physical disability, there's going to be certain things that they need help with. And there's maybe going to be other stuff that they can be very independent with. If you have a student who maybe does not have a physical disability or motor issues, they might be really great at getting themselves dressed. Maybe there's more of a cognitive delay or just sort of the common sense isn't as high. And maybe they have more trouble picking out appropriate outfits. And so the goal is always to see what is the most that your child can do.
Yeah. And thinking, you know, there's Kristen wrote this great line in the book where she's like, they may not have their own apartment, but what if they could live with a roommate in an apartment with support? You know, they may not have a full-time job as CEO of a company, but that doesn't mean that they can't have a job that's fulfilling with coworkers that care about them and build community. And so it's not that we're saying, you know, no to people, but rather we're saying, you know, when we think about what young adults can do, you know, if it's not this high, it's failure. We need, that needs to go away, right? We have parents who are thinking, well, they can't go to law school, therefore they're not independent, or they can't go. And the majority of people in the world don't go to law school. I didn't go to law school. And you know, I'm fairly independent. And so again, thinking about less about what your kid can't do and thinking more about ways to reframe, you know, living in your own apartment. Well, there are lots of millennials who live at home with their parents because rent is incredibly high, right? Does that mean they're not really adults? So again, thinking about this not as what they can't do, but rather what works for them and what would make them feel fulfilled. You know, having a job where people care about you and you like your work, that's the dream for most people. And they could have that. There's no reason they can't have that.
I appreciate that, because personally speaking, you know, I work with a variety of families and we talk about top priorities, and a lot of them will say like, oh, I want them to be independent, but independence looks so different on every single person. What types of values do you have that might mean independence? Do you mean communication? Do you mean, you know, being able to dress themselves in the morning, being able to drive a car, own their own place, you know, and there's even things as neurotypical adults can't do. You know, you guys touched on a lot of millennials who live with their parents because rent is incredibly high. I am the same person. I have lived on my own before, but rent down in Florida is at least $2,000 plus a month for a two-bedroom apartment. You know, so I definitely understand that, because independence can look very different, and it seems like from your guys' perspective, and please correct me if I'm wrong here, but independence looks different on everybody. And it's a matter of finding what specific areas are most valuable to lead them towards independence.
Yes. And I think one of our driving forces is, like we were talking about before, services fade out as kids get older, right? And there's a line in the book about when services end at 21 and you sort of get kicked out of that public school system, it's like falling off a cliff. And I think Christine wrote that line. And the parents go from having their kid, their young adult at that point, involved in a 5-day-a-week program that's all day, to potentially nothing. And that's a problem. It's a problem because a lot of times these kids do better with structure. Everybody needs something in their life. Nobody is happy sitting at home on the couch all day watching TV. So now you run into like mental health issues or like depression and anxiety. I find that anytime, I think for anybody, but especially with the neurodiverse population, that when you start making their world small, it makes it that much harder to make it big again. It's like the anxiety builds. Like, I haven't left the house in 3 weeks and now all of a sudden you want me to go socialize. So I always tell parents, let's really think about what we want this life to look like, his or her life to look like at 21. Do you want them to have a job? That's a fulfilling thing, to have a job and be bringing money in. Well, if you want them to have a job, what do we need to be doing now to start preparing for them to have a job? right? And there's a lot of, I'm still seeing where there's this mentality on some level. I know there's a lot of different mentalities happening right now, but one of the mentalities that I'm seeing is, well, but my child has special needs, so like the world is going to cater to them. And like, no, they're not. Not if we're aiming for competitive employment. If we're aiming for competitive employment, your kid needs to do the job appropriately and at the same level as anybody else who they would have hired in order to keep their job. Now, if your goal is for them to go work in like a sheltered workforce where maybe the standards are lower, then that's a different story. But we're not generally aiming for that. We're aiming for competitive employment. We're aiming for inclusive higher ed. We're aiming for independence in living, whatever that looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. One of the things that you also mentioned in the book was using task analyses as a foundational teaching method to be able to teach independence. Why do you believe this strategy is so effective for building life skills?
Yeah, so a couple things. One thing about it is that it takes, my kid can't, let's say we're talking about toothbrushing, that's the one that we use in the book a lot. I can't, my child cannot brush their teeth. Are we sure about that, first of all? Because maybe if they can walk into the bathroom, that is part of brushing teeth. If they can get out their toothbrush, that is part of brushing teeth. If they can get out the toothpaste. And so rather than saying they can't and just kind of putting a big X on the whole activity, the whole task, when you break it down and you have the parents actually see what they can and can't do, it becomes more clear. And you might have a young adult who can do 80% of the steps on their own, and they are just dealing with the cap on the toothpaste throws them every time. That is valuable information because then you can plan around that. The other thing is that the kind of the data collection is built in some ways compared to other types of methods that we could use. And so, yeah, it's just this, I find it really helpful. I think it's very parent friendly. And I think, again, it gives parents a generalizable skill. So we teach them task analysis, which they then can use with toothbrushing, with getting ready in the morning, with showering, with shaving, with, you know, making a lunch. And so once they learn that process of task analysis and what the product is, they then can generalize it. So I think it's powerful in multiple ways, particularly for parents.
It also helps when you can pinpoint, like Christine said, sometimes there's just this one piece that they're stuck with. Like maybe for the toothbrushing, they're stuck on that they can't get the cap on and off the toothpaste. Okay, great. So if we really can't get past that, we're working with an OT, it's not happening, then maybe we're getting an automatic toothpaste dispenser. So we're making an accommodation so that they can still accomplish the goal of brushing their teeth. But it's very hard to figure out those accommodations if you're looking at this, they just can't brush their teeth and it's this big thing. You have to sort of narrow down where the problem is so that you have a chance of being able to make the accommodation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I appreciate that because, again, you know, when it comes to task analyses, for those who are listening, task analyses, we take a skill and we break it down to its smallest parts, right? So you teach one step at a time. And if something, you know, might take a lot of different steps, teaching it one little bit at a time might ultimately help them get to the point of being able to do the entire skill, you know? And so sometimes it might take having to teach a couple of those steps little by little so that way they can finally get to the end product. Brushing teeth is a perfect example. Brushing teeth takes at least 10-ish steps when you're thinking about it. You know, it's not just grab a toothbrush and brush your teeth. No, it's you get the toothbrush, you get the toothpaste, you put the toothpaste on the toothbrush, you turn on the water, you wet the brush, you know, so it's there's so many different steps that are involved. And when we take the time to be able to break down those steps and teach them, that's a really good way to help our learners, you know, be able to get to that terminal goal.
Well, and the other great thing about it is that our parents make, in the book, we walk them through the process of making the task analysis. So it's not just some arbitrary task analysis that we're like, here are the steps for brushing teeth, because maybe in your house, you form a cup with your hand and you drink water out of your hand rather than a cup on the side, right? Or maybe you have, a timer in your hand and you use the timer to tell them when to take it. Great, put that in the task analysis. It's not a one size fits all, right? A task analysis, if you find one online, it's probably not going to work for you, right? Because every person does these processes a little bit different. And so again, it's that ability to make it specific to your child, to your house. You can add pictures of things in your house for your child versus, oh, this one size fits all thing. You know, I found a task analysis online and it says that we should wet the toothbrush before we put the toothpaste on. Well, that's arbitrary. In your house, in your culture of brushing your teeth, it might look different. Or maybe your kid doesn't like the sound of running water and you brush teeth and then you only turn the water on at the very end to get water in a glass. So again, it's very individualized and we have the parents walk through the process with the child to make sure that it fits them rather than the other way around.
We also got a very interesting review last week on the book, and the reviewer is on the spectrum herself. And what she said is she found it fascinating that neurotypical people view something like brushing their teeth as one task, because in her mind, of course, it's 20 different steps. And so I think that that's important too. One, for the parents to realize that it's not necessarily just one task, or that your kid's not viewing it as one task. And that a lot of times when things are broken down and they're more specific and in smaller pieces, that helps. I mean, that's part of the reason why ABA has worked all of these years, right? Is that when it's broken down and it's measurable and it's objective, it makes it easier for the kids to learn and for the progress to be tracked.
Absolutely. What do you say to a parent that reads about task analyses, or really anybody who reads about task analyses and thinks, this sounds like a lot of work and I'm already burnt out by this? What do you have to say to that?
It is a lot of work. We acknowledge that. We're big believers in pick one thing first. Like, so don't try to work on everything at once. Like, if you're going to do toothbrushing, just do toothbrushing. You're not going to do toothbrushing, showering, dressing all at the same time. There's a whole chapter. There's two chapters in the beginning of the book. One about is your child ready? And the other one is, are you ready as the parent? So like, if you just had a baby and your house is under construction, this is not the time to do this, because you're already going to be scattered with all these things going on. But what we also say to them is, it's a lot of work to still be showering your kid when they're 15. You know, nobody wants to be doing that. So when you put the time in earlier, you're long term, you're saving yourself a lot of time, like over the course of their life then.
Yeah, and we, you know, the chapter walks parents through this assessment process for themselves, right? Are these barriers present? If they are present, no problem. But how can we work around them? What can we do? We use the phrase, put your oxygen mask on first. So if a parent is burnt out and struggling and stressed and, then this is going to feel like one more thing piled on top versus, okay, I'm going to shift this and I'm going to shift this and I'm going to make room for this new thing that is of high importance to me. And that shift versus like, oh, we're telling you, we're putting something on you versus you are making space for this thing that will pay dividends in the long run. I think that's a very different way of thinking about it, versus a professional coming in and being like, you have to do, you know, this is the thing. Versus saying like, oh, I see the appeal of this. I understand why I need to do it. Let me, you know, shift things. Let me figure it out. We give some, I think they're practical ideas, but maybe they're not, you know, they're practical ideas about, you know, do you have a calming method for yourself? Because when you go from doing 100% of the toothbrushing for your child to your child having to do some, you may get some pushback. They may be like, excuse me, why? Some of them are going to be excited, right? They're going to want to do it themselves. They're going to want that independence. Some of them are going to be like, excuse me, I'm used to putting in this much work, and now you want me to put in this much work. We would all be annoyed, right, if our job suddenly required 100% more work than we already do. And so having those calming techniques, having the ability to ask for help, having all these things in place can really help a parent to kind of fortify before they begin these things. And most people, I think a lot of people are going to see the gains pretty quickly. And so, you know, that can be, it becomes its own reinforcement for the parent. But getting over that initial hump of starting something new can feel really overwhelming.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, between that, you know, potentially like you're starting out with 100% of you doing it all, then you're taking yourself out of the equation little by little, and then having to deal with potential resistance, that has to be a lot. And then another thing that you guys talked about in the book was collecting data. And that's another task that they have to do on top of that. So you can only imagine how much burnout that might have on top of that too. And with data collection, how can families do this in a manageable way? And why does it matter at the end of the day?
Well, there's a couple of sections in the book that talk about, for example, filming, like staying with the toothbrushing example. Film your child doing the toothbrushing example, and then you can always go back and watch it later and fill in the prompts versus trying to do it all at once, because it's a lot. The other thing is, we said to them, it's not that you have to take data every single time your child brushes their teeth, because we know that that's a huge ask and not realistic. But even if they're doing it once a week or twice a week, you now you have these checkpoints, because it's so easy to lose sight about where you started and how far you've come. And so by having that data, they're able to, maybe they're frustrated in that moment because they're having a bad day, but then when they go back and look at where they started, they're like, oh, look at this. We really did make a lot of progress. And it gives you the motivation to keep moving.
Well, and even, you know, I did my dissertation on adolescence with challenging behavior, and I had multiple participants disqualified from the study because me calling the parents, we did video conferences all over telehealth, me calling at 7 o'clock every night and having them help their child brush their teeth, the challenging behavior went away, because all that young adult needed was consistency of routine and to know the expectations of brushing teeth. And then they didn't qualify for my, which is great. Great news, but this happens, right? Where even the power of getting into a routine and of setting expectations can sometimes address some of that resistance, right? So part of the resistance at the beginning is, well, normally you come meet me in my room and you brush my teeth while I lay on the floor. And now you're asking me to get up and go to the bathroom to brush my teeth. So of course it's going to, that's a change, right? And for our young adults with who are neurodiverse, change can be difficult. But once that expectation is set that like we brush our teeth in the bathroom, we spit in the sink, et cetera, you know, that can by itself be helpful for some of these resistance issues.
Absolutely. I think too, you know, it takes having to sort of model that behavior, leading that behavior and showing them, hey, like, this is why we do this. You know, it's not just like we're asking our students to do something just for the sake of doing it. It's because there's these natural contingencies, these natural things that are a part of life. You know, we want to teach them, hey, this is what it takes to navigate independence, navigating the real world. And of course, at the beginning, there's going to be some resistance. Absolutely. I can definitely understand that. Change is very hard for not just neurodiverse students, but when you think about it, change is hard for a lot of people. You know, we all go through changes and it's not easy to navigate. But at the same time, if we continue to support our students through it, you know, I feel like we can give the most empathy, we can be the most empathetic by showing them, hey, you're safe. You know, this is just a part of life. It is a change, but you are still safe in this, and we will help you through this.
Well, yeah, and the natural consequences, I think, for these particular skills are so distal, right? You can not brush your teeth. That is a choice, right? You as an adult person do not have to brush your teeth. Will it make you unpopular at the office? Yes. Will you maybe have client, you know, we're talking about, you know, BCBAs, clients and families. If you work with autistic children, they will tell you your teeth are yellow. but if you don't work with autistic children, maybe no one says anything. Maybe there are no immediate or even distal social consequences to that. The consequences come in 3 years when you go to the dentist and you have to have scaling done on your teeth, where they crack all the stuff off. You have to have shots in your mouth for anesthesia. You have to have 10 cavities filled, right? But again, those consequences are 3 years away. And that is something that is not nearly, but it's very difficult to teach, right? You can show people videos of teeth, you know, you can give examples, but until it happens to a person, I think it does not feel like a real potential outcome. So yeah, those natural consequences are just, they're just too far removed for something like toothbrushing you can explain to an 8-year-old, you'll have to have some, you know, dentists come in. They don't know what that means. They don't have the context for what that means. And so, that's a big barrier, I think, for acquiring these skills, is those consequences being so far removed.
I also want to say that same mentality sort of answers your question before about that this is a lot of work for the parents. I don't think most parents who have a 6, 7, 8-year-old and are bathing them, in that moment, there's so much going on. They're not thinking about what does this look like at 12, 13, 14, once my child has hit puberty. And when you point that out to them, they're like, oh, you know what? You're right. Like, I don't want to be showering my son at 14 because that would be uncomfortable for all involved. And maybe I should start working on this now. You know, I don't want my child or young adult at 21 sitting at home on my couch doing nothing when their public school program ends. Maybe I should be thinking about that now and have a plan in place.
Well, and sort of the unspoken thing, so I teach sexuality and relationship education at the university, and something that we didn't explicitly talk about in this book, but I is something that is true, is that when you are able to care for yourself, that you may then, you have less exposure to caregivers in the bathroom with you. There's not an excuse for someone to be in there with you. It's very clear that something has gone wrong if there is an adult in the bathroom with this person. And so I think, you know, it can be a protective factor against abuse. Because again, if you can go to the bathroom by yourself, then if someone is in there, that's an immediate red flag and a problem. Whereas if you're used to people being in the bathroom with you while you're going to the bathroom, that boundary is very, you know, unclear. Whereas if they can shower and go to the bathroom, there is a clear boundary, then you should be in the bathroom by yourself. There's no need for a caregiver, support person, other person to be in there with you. And so that's something that, you know, I think about as someone, again, who sees the consent issues with students when they come to college, of them not understanding personal space, not understanding touch, and when it's appropriate and not appropriate. Some of that, I think, can be attributed to people being overly involved or touching or standing close during these self-care tasks, these times that really should be, there should be plenty of space between you and other people, right? When we're in the bathroom, we don't get close to people. When we are, you know, brushing our teeth, that's an independent activity. We do not need someone with us.
I appreciate that you guys brought up the boundaries and, you know, the especially like the consent and abuse, because, you know, as you may know, neurodiverse students are more likely to be faced with sexual assault. And that is something that we have to be very mindful of. You know, so when we're teaching those independent skills, we also need to teach some of those other nuances, such as consent, boundaries. When you're in the bathroom, you know, being able to be in the bathroom by yourself, removing yourself, you know, those are all things that we have to look at, not just completing the skill yourself. You know, there's a lot of things that are involved with independence that go beyond just teaching a specific skill. So I really appreciate that you guys talked about that. Wonderful. I'm going to go ahead and drop that first code word. That first code word has been a word that we have said throughout the entire podcast, and it is independence. That is independence. That is the word independence. So a theme that has been throughout the book is empowering rather than enabling. How can caregivers tell when they've crossed that line?
So there's a difference between prompting your child through a sequence and doing it for them. So if, for example, with the toothbrushing, if you're just brushing their teeth, you're enabling. If you are hand over hand prompting them to brush their own teeth, now you're empowering, as long as you are then also working to fade those prompts, right? You don't want to get stuck at like, I'm hand over hand prompting them to brush their teeth. But if you have a plan in place to fade those prompts so that eventually they're doing it independently, then it's empowering.
Absolutely. I can definitely understand that, you know, especially because we want to make sure that at the end of the day, we are teaching these skills. And yet at the same time, you know, we're not just giving in because of, you know, some like just because of something, you know, we want to make sure that we're actually like teaching the skill to reach them towards independence.
Yes. But what I hear most often, it comes up with the shoes a lot with a little kid. I'm like, is Johnny putting on his shoes? No. Okay. Well, why? He doesn't know how. Okay. Are you showing him? Well, no, I'm just putting them on. We're in a rush in the morning. I'm like, okay, well, he's not going to magically learn how to put on his shoes if you're doing it for him every morning. So show him, even if you can't, either leave yourself an extra 5 minutes in the morning or practice it at another time during the day. And then I'll hear things sometimes with the jackets or with the shoes. Well, he can't put on the shoes because they're high tops, or he can't do this zipper on this jacket because the zipper is small. Well, then get a pair of shoes that he can put on, or get a jacket that has a large zipper. They can be a little bit harder to find, but they do make jackets that have larger zippers so that your child has a chance of being able to be independent with those things.
Yeah, I think we talk a lot about tailoring the environment, and there's even an example where we talk about how parents child-proof their houses, right? They make sure everything is safe. Everything's locked up. They remove hazards. They put everything up, right? They put little things in the door. But then for your child to be independent, sometimes you have to un-child-proof, right? You have to think about, well, if that thing is on the shelf and he wants it, and we were working on requesting, right? We're working on manding, but now he's got it. Well, why are his snacks still up high where he can't get them? And how can I move them to some place where he can access them independently? And so it's also about assessing the environment that you have around, right? So the high tops. Okay. I know they're the height of fashion. However, if you can't get them on and off your feet, they are not really useful to you in the long run. And so thinking too, you know, one of the examples we give is, especially with our kids that are growing all the time, that their pajamas will turn into high water pajamas up to their calf, you know, before you know it. And then they're struggling with that. Well, that's a barrier that's easily removed. Getting them pajamas that fit them mean that you're not fighting with them to fight to put on their pajamas. So it's also about thinking, what are the barriers? And part of the task analysis is identifying those barriers and seeing where you can accommodate rather than do it for them, or, you know, just push through because we have to get on the bus in the morning.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can definitely understand that. When you have that, you have resistance, you know, there can be a lot that can happen in those moments. So how do you balance high expectations with compassion, especially when a child is struggling with even what may be perceived as basic tasks?
Well, first of all, I don't know that basic tasks is a helpful thing to think about, right? Because I do 50, 11 million basic tasks a day. They still take time. There's still things I have to do. And just because I'm able to kind of like automate them doesn't mean that they don't matter, right? Brushing my teeth is a basic task, but then, you know, if I don't do it, there are consequences. So, yeah, absolutely. I think the struggle for a lot of parents is going to be in this like initial resistance and in maintaining consistency. So once you get over that hump of, okay, where we know we need to get up off the floor of our bedroom and walk into the bathroom to do our toothbrushing, we've got that figured out. But then it kind of sustaining that effort can be really difficult, right? So we have the whole chapter about setting yourself up for success, but let's say you do it for a week, but you're about to go on vacation where the schedule changes and everything is up in the air and whatever, whatever. Maintaining toothbrushing in a new environment, you're basically teaching the skill over again at that point. So we do talk about setting yourself up for success, and thinking about that. But I think, again, most parents are incredibly compassionate toward their children. They do not want to see them struggle. They do not want to see them suffer. They do not want them to have a hard time. And so I think that compassion is already there in parents and in professionals. However, we can't let that override the bigger picture, which is that this independence will serve them for the rest of their life. So struggle in the moment versus struggle for the rest of their life. So if, go
I think
ahead.
it's also important to be clear that you set the bar high. So maybe the goal is to brush your teeth independently or shower independently. It doesn't mean that on day one you're expecting them to do that, because that's when then the compassion's not there. If the big goal is I want you to brush your teeth, but right now I'm only asking you to take one step, if the expectation is fair, I think the compassion is there.
I like that. I like that. You know, when the expectation is fair, then the compassion is there. I really like that. And, you know, going back to basic tasks, you know, I don't like the word basic tasks either. You know, I guess like that's just sort of that's a subjective term, right? You know, so what you may feel is basic may be very complex for a student. And so that's where I can definitely understand when it comes to when it comes to just teaching that one step, you know, it might seem like a basic task to, you know, you, myself, you know, to anybody that already knows how to acquire these skills, that already knows how to do this skill, but that might be super complex for a variety of reasons. Think about, you know, things like dexterity, think about things like motor skills, think about, you know, just the changes in general. There's so many things that we have to consider.
Yes, I think there's an example in the beginning of the book about think about what your morning would look like if your arm was broken. And now all of a sudden you're trying to brush your teeth with one hand. All of a sudden things get much harder, they take much longer. You're super frustrated, and it's a very different spin on what those activities look like for a child that has a motor planning issue or has some sort of physical disability. You know, you could have a child that has a really hard time getting dressed. They might be a math whiz, and maybe math is really easy to them, but like putting their shirt on is very challenging. So I think what is an easy task for one person doesn't necessarily make an easy task for another person.
Absolutely. 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 Yeah. And one of the things I really liked about the book too is that you that the book shares many real world vignettes. How did you gather those stories? Why did you choose to include them in the book?
Those were sort of compilation stories from our, 35, 40 years of experience of being in the field. They're stories that come up commonly, you know, when you're working. And we chose to include them because we felt like it was something that parents could really relate to. It's one thing to hear all the facts in the research, which Christine did a beautiful job with in one of the early chapters. It's another thing to be told, this is what you need to do and here's why, right? But then it's a totally different thing to bring the emotion into it and say, this is likely what your morning routine is looking like and the struggle that you're going through and that your child's going through. And here's what this could look like later.
Yeah. And, you know, I worked in a middle school. I've worked in inclusive higher ed. I have, you know, taught future teachers who bring me their stories. And I think, again, it's not necessarily that these are true for every family, but rather that families can identify with pieces of each story. You know, they can think back to, oh, yep, that was how it was when they were little, or this is how it is when. And so giving these examples to also, we made sure to illustrate whatever point was happening in the chapter. So the chapter where we determine, you know, whether this book is right for your child has a section, it has a vignette describing a family with three different children with disabilities, which is a situation that a lot of families have, and how each of them have a different level of readiness for independence. And so, we wanted to reflect the lived experiences of these families, and we wanted to reflect the lived experiences of these young adults and children who are neurodiverse. I think that was something that it also softens, right? So we're going to, the chapter with all the statistics, they are bleak. They're not great. And so it, again, gives the parent something to kind of hold on to as an example. And then we give them the statistics. And it was a way of softening our approach, of making it more understandable for parents, for them to grab onto. And then also just as kind of a break. In between these, where we're asking them to do really difficult, sometimes really difficult things, and giving them kind of this respite of like, let's read about a situation, let's read about a scenario that you can identify with.
I appreciate that because, you know, looking at the different vignettes, that is reality. You know, that is something that we, as, you know, people face every single day. And so seeing those vignettes for me was really just relating back to my own life, relating back to what my mom went through when, you know, I was growing up as well. And so I hope, you know, by reading and kind of like getting those vignettes, you know, people can understand, hey, like this is real life. This is what happens in daily life. And we do have to think about those. We do have to think about how we can navigate those in the future.
Well, and, you know, the book is aimed at, of course, anyone can pick up the book, but the book is aimed at, you know, we said 8-ish, 6, 11. And so we give vignettes about the future for those families too, things that maybe they haven't thought about. And so, again, bringing it in, maybe the parent of an 8-year-old isn't aware about the service cliff that they're going to drive off of when their child hits 21 or 22, depending on where they live. And so again, it's not to scare them, but to just let them know, because I don't think the average elementary school special ed teacher is talking to parents about that. They should be. That would be a great thing. But, you know, maybe the parents aren't ready to talk about that. Maybe someone has tried to talk to them about it and they're not ready. But again, regardless of whether you're ready or not, 21 comes. 21 and 22, they show up. They knock on your door. You cannot prevent that. So, you know, again, this happens a lot with the sex ed stuff that I teach. Parents are like, well, what if they're not ready? And I say, well, they're at college. It doesn't matter if they're ready anymore. It doesn't matter. The situation needs these skills. We are going to teach these skills. And so, again, I think there's this idea of they're not ready, not from the skill perspective. Obviously, we talk about that, but they're not mentally ready. They're not, you know, whatever it is that the parents are thinking. But I mean, we have to learn the skill, right? We have to. And so I think giving them that forward thinking, those scenarios for 11-year-olds, 13-year-olds, 15-year-olds, maybe will help them kind of think that long-term planning a little bit differently.
You're absolutely right when it comes to, you know, the 21's going to knock on your door very, very soon. And that's not preventable. There's no way to prevent that. And, you know, there's a lot with, you know, not being ready to address it, not being ready to discuss it. And that's scary. I can understand that. I can definitely understand that there's a lot to think about for the future. That being said, how early do you think families should start thinking about the futures?
Listen, I think prior to five, for most families, if we're, especially if we're talking about autism, you're trying to get them ready for kindergarten. And you're not thinking about college. You're just thinking about, like, I'm switching from early intervention to preschool services and into CSE to get into the district. And that's really your focus. And I think you also, not maybe in some cases you do know, but I think there's a lot of cases where you don't really know what your kid's full potential is at that age. So you're really not quite sure what, you know, where we're going still. I think that by the time the child's in kindergarten, six, seven, you want to start working on, like, can they dress themselves? Can they brush their teeth? I mean, those are skills that neurotypical kids are have under control, you know, by that age. You don't necessarily need to be worried about what kind of college program or are they going to college at five or six. But if there's not a significant motor issue or a safety concern, like them eloping or pica, start working on putting their pants on. Start working on, this is how you wash your body, you know, when you're in the bath. And then I think as they get older is when you really start looking about, maybe by the time they're 10, 11, you start really thinking about, what is this going to look like down the road? What does this look like 10 years from now?
Right. But it's not something that you can wait on. I think this is something that, you know, it gets kind of pushed to the side, right? So potty training is a big one, right? But once they're potty trained, it gets kind of wibbly, you know, toileting gets kind of pushed to the back. And so, you know, I know quite a few clients, and maybe Kristen, this is unique, maybe you have not dealt with this, where they get potty trained for urination, but not for defecation.
I've seen that before personally.
Right. And so it becomes this thing of, we're just going to kick this. Oh, well, they're not peeing themselves, you know, so that's good. And we made progress, but that just becomes something that, like, parents deal with. And so, you know, even when you have a therapy team, so much of this just gets put back on parents, unless you have a therapist that's coming into the home and doing things very often. And so, yeah, I think it's something that gets pushed, and then it becomes yet another thing that parents are solely responsible for. And so, yeah, again, the earlier you start, the better, the more people, the more, you know, therapists you get involved in the process who have different perspectives, you know, the better. You know, Kristen's talked about how the work that she's doing on with her 24-year-old clients informs her work that she does with her 5-year-old clients. And so, again, it's this really thinking about the long term, even when it's difficult, even when it can be really hard.
And I think parents need to keep in mind that if you have a child that has motor delays or retention issues or whatever it is, it's going to take them likely longer to learn something. So you don't, like, so for example, I have my foster son is 2.5, and he insisted one day on learning how to put his jacket on himself. And I was sort of like, I don't know if we're ready for this. Well, he had it down in 2 days. I mean, I was shocked. I've had kids where it's taken 6 months, 9 months for them to figure out how to put their jacket on and get that motor planning piece down. So the sooner you start, wherever it is, wherever you need to start, and however small that step is, you're that much further along a year from now or 2 years from now versus if you just wait and start in 2 years.
Yeah, and thinking of missed opportunities. So, you know, if we're working on toothbrushing, that's twice a day times 365 days times 3 years. And that is all missed learning opportunities. And you can't get that back. You know, that. So the other thing, when I was teaching, and I teach special ed teachers, and we talk about the importance of using evidence-based practices, because the number of minutes, right, it's in their IEP as minutes, the number of minutes that you have with them is finite. The number of minutes they have until they turn 21 is finite. And we need to get every morsel of progress out of those minutes that we possibly can. And so again, we're thinking about in 21 knocking on our door, there is a certain number of minutes. There's a certain number of toothbrushings between now and then. And then you're out of toothbrushing opportunities, right? You're out of, right? They're going to go to college. They're going to go live independently, whatever. But there's only so many opportunities you have. And so the sooner you start, the more advantage you can take of the opportunities you do have.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I can definitely agree with that. And, you know, especially because you only have so many opportunities in life, you can't take those back. You have to be able to bank on those opportunities and really make sure that you are moving towards getting as many opportunities as possible. Thank you so much for sharing that. I really do appreciate that.
It's also easier, just to say one more thing, it's also easier to do these things and not have the added pressure of feeling rushed. So I say to parents sometimes, listen, this might be a little bit early to start this, but let's start it because we can just do it calmly versus, you know, all of a sudden your kid's 15 and you're realizing that there's all these skills you need to work on and you're in a big rush because in 3 years, they're potentially leaving their school system and going to need to like go on. And I've had kids who need to go on to just a gen ed college program. They don't qualify for inclusive higher ed. And now all of a sudden there's this huge level of independence and you're stressed about the time. The earlier you start, the less that stress is there.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. And I want to go ahead and drop that second code word. That second code word is neurodiverse. That's NEURODIVERSE. That is neurodiverse. Let me ask you guys this. How has your own practice or perspective changed since you've written the book?
Yeah, so I think my change has been thinking about how much work it takes to get to where my students are, my college students. And I think being appreciative of the work that parents have done, the work that professionals have done, while also understanding that there's more that could be done and there's more that could be brought to the table. So I think that was great. We had parent readers throughout the process of developing this book. And I think, you know, they steered us clear of some mistakes that we could have made early on. So I know I am much more grateful to both the parents that we have worked with directly and just parents who are on this independence journey. And I think, again, it's we grounded ourselves very clearly in the book as not parents, right? As professionals who, you know, have this very specific perspective while bringing in the perspective of parents as well, but not trying to own that perspective. So I think just my appreciation for parents has grown and my appreciation for the advocacy that they do has grown. And, you know, we've heard a lot of stories from parents since we've written the book. And so, you know, that's something that I hold very dear, and I appreciate their trust in us. Even with trying what's in the book, that's a lot of trust. And so I'm much more appreciative than I used to be.
I think my big shift actually came before we wrote the book, which was going to these inclusive higher ed conferences and even knowing that these existed, because for so long, we didn't have any on Long Island. It wasn't something that I had heard of. It wasn't something that the kids were being prepared for in the high school programs. And like Christine's saying, where her gratitude is towards these parents and how much work they're putting in, I have so much gratitude for all these professionals who are pushing this inclusive higher ed programs and education further along and getting more of them out there so that more kids have access to them. It's a wonder. I always say to parents, I know it's a huge goal, and I know it's okay. Let's aim for it. And if we don't make it, it doesn't matter. We're that much better off that we were trying for it. And it's a really big deal to have a big goal that you're aiming for, in my mind, because that's what keeps the motivation up. It keeps the momentum going. It keeps the excitement there. So that was a really big deal for me.
That's awesome. I can definitely imagine, you know, how much has changed and how much you guys have really thought about, you know, everything, writing the book, even before writing the book, even I would even imagine even after publishing the book, you know, getting feedback from your readers, you know, that's definitely something that I find so fascinating. And again, I think a book like this is absolutely needed, you know, for our parents who have neurodiverse children. And, you know, I definitely appreciate that you guys wrote this, because there's so many real world examples.
The fun part is that this was not the book we sat down to write. The book we sat down to write was getting your student into college. I know it was okay. It's silly now that I say it out loud, obviously, but we were like, nope, we're going to write this one book. It's going to get them ready for college. And we started outlining, and then we were outlining, and then we were outlining, and then we were outlining, and we were like 7 pages into an outline. And I was like, this is not one book.
No. And then Christine said, we need a chapter on sex ed. And I said, that cannot be in the first book. I said, these parents, the kids aren't even showering themselves. You start talking about sex ed, nobody's going to college. They're going to put the book down, and that's going to be the end of it. So we had it back all the way up to the beginning. And now what we're hoping then is that subsequent books will get higher.
And it's this idea of independence at home, right? So within your home, independence in the community, right? And then independent living. Because, you know, if you are starting at the college level and you don't have the independence at home or the independence in community skills, college is, it's going to be rough if you're even going to make it to Thanksgiving break, right? If you don't know how to grocery shop, if you don't know how to order your own food, if you don't, you know, all these things that if your parents have been doing them for you, it's also just a lot to take on at the same time versus starting when they're 8, building slowly through their teens until they are, in fact, at the age they need to be to get to college.
Absolutely. What do you hope readers feel when they finish the final page of Spectrum of Independence?
I think hope, you know, that there's sort of a light. The day-to-day can get very challenging, I think, as a parent. And to see that there's a light potentially a light at the end of the tunnel, this is what we're aiming for, and that this is what, you know, what the future could look like.
Yeah, and if they have followed the book in the way, because basically there are parts of the book where like, okay, put the book down, go do the thing that we just told you to do. You know, and that happens in multiple chapters. We're like, okay, great. You know, it's not something that you can sit down and read it cover to cover. Absolutely. If it's that compelling, I love that. But there are parts where we're like, okay, now you go make the task analysis. Okay, now you go try the task analysis. Okay, and so by the end, if they are following it in that sequence, I hope by the end they feel accomplished. Reading a whole book for anyone at this point is an accomplishment, but then also that they have learned a new skill. They have given their child new skills, or young adult, depending on when they're starting these skills. They have backed themselves out, right? They have faded their presence as much as possible. And so I hope they can feel accomplished and see the progress that their child and they themselves have made on this independence journey.
I like that. I like that a lot. If a parent could take away only one message or strategy from this book, what would you want that to be?
I think, to me, realizing that task that you view as just this one thing is really a whole bunch of little tasks that make up that big task, because likely that's how your child is viewing it.
Yeah, and I think for my message would be, the future comes faster than you think. And that starting now, you know, what's the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time to plant a tree is today. So, you know, yes, of course, you could have started this maybe 5 years ago, but you could also start today. And that is going to be better than starting tomorrow or the day after or the day after or the day after, right? So I think it's just seizing, right, assessing your situation, but then also making space and seizing this time that you have with your child at home to really maximize their future.
Thank you both so much for coming on to the podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about Spectrum of Independence, all the advice that you have, all of the tips that you have for families. I really, truly appreciate you taking the time to come out and talk about this. And that being said, where can our listeners find your book, and how can they get a hold of you?
Our book is being sold on Amazon and also through Guilford Press. We have a website specifically for the book, spectrumofindependence.com, and that will bring that has links like to the Amazon page. And then also my private practice website is zealbehavior.com.
And I'm at Auburn University, so I have an Auburn email that you're welcome to email me at. And then all of our contact information is also on the website, including LinkedIn. And so we are on the internet, so you can find us there. We're really grateful to you for having us on as well. You know, we were talking about how this is our first professional focused podcast. We've been on quite a few parent podcasts. And so the questions are really different when you're speaking to professionals. And so this has been a really good way to stretch how we think about the book and kind of reflect. So this was really helpful and wonderful for us as well.
Thank you so much, Kristen and Christine. I cannot tell you enough how much I appreciate your time. And thank you, everybody, for listening in on today's episode. I've been your host, Michelle Zeman, and I will see you on the next one. Bye.